FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome, and you are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz, and today's 6/18/18. If you're a numerologist or otherwise inclined to the occult, make what you will of it. Hey, as always, join the conversation, join the discussion, be part of the show. The email address, in case you don't have it, kl@kerrylutz.com. So we saw gold, silver, precious metals take a large hit last Friday, just when it looked like it was safe to go outside, that they were getting ready to break out. What does it all mean? Well, let's find out what it means. I'm really pleased to have with us today a gentleman, first time on the show, Keith Wiener. Keith, you're pretty well known for a couple of theories you have. One is about the marginal productivity of debt, and the other concept is yield purchasing power. Here to talk about precious metals, the dollar, the monetary system, etc. We need all the help we can get trying to understand exactly what's going on. And hey, if you're looking to connect with Keith, the website is monetary-metals.com. And Keith, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Hey, so, all right. So gold, silver, they look like they're getting ready to break out. And last Friday, something happened. You know, gold's down $23 the ounce. Silver is down around 60, and it's enough to make one's head explode if you don't know what's going on, isn't it?
A lot of people get pretty upset about that, those little moves.
Little temporary moves. So what's your take on it? What's going on here?
So we track something that we call the fundamentals of gold and silver. That is, by looking at the spread between spot and futures, we can tell what's going on. And we've built a model that says, assuming there weren't any speculators using leverage, and those speculators can sometimes push the price up and sometimes they can push the price down, where would the price be clearing at? And so the fundamental price in gold had really blipped up this spring to about $1,500. And now it's coming back down. It's long-term sort of stable range. And interestingly, this week, the fundamentals in silver improved. And so what can happen is that the speculators decide that they think something is going to happen. Sometimes they're right, but often they're not. And then they try to front run whatever it is they think is coming. They think the price is going to drop. They're all tripping over themselves to front run each other to sell. And I think that's what happened in silver on Friday. And so the fundamentals actually strengthened on Friday. And yet there was this huge sell-off. So if you're looking at price charts, you might have thought, before Friday that silver was breaking out. And then if you watch Friday, you think, okay, well, silver is now getting smashed down. But if you look at the fundamental chart, which we publish on our website, you say, you know what, not really a whole hell of a lot changed. The speculators reposition themselves. And now silver is obviously quite a bit cheaper than it was on Friday, Thursday night, Friday morning, but not a whole hell of a lot changed.
Mm-hmm. I see. So it's just a short-term little gyration that drives traders, I guess, and those who watch gold and believe in its long-term viability, maybe not as a medium of exchange, but as a store of value, drives you nuts. So what do you do in this situation? Is this a buying opportunity? Is this a sit back in your seat, kick your shoes off and hang out and wait? What do you do here?
I always say to somebody who doesn't have any gold and any silver, you should buy some regardless of the price or the market condition, because otherwise you're just all in on the dollar. If you're positioned, and you have some gold and you have some silver, I certainly wouldn't be selling at this point, but I'm not sure. I think I would wait to see the fundamentals in silver, I'm sorry, in gold still drifting down. That's potentially if that continues, obviously going to be a buying opportunity. And, you know, maybe you buy a little bit of silver here, mm-hmm. but I don't have a really strong conviction in terms of trading price where it is today.
Mm-hmm. So as far as down the road here, let's talk about your economic viewpoint or outlook on the country. So first, we've got this thing, the marginal productivity of debt, which, if I might assume or presume to understand it, is how much additional output do you get for every dollar of debt you take on? Or do you get any, or does it turn destructive? Do I have that right?
Yeah, basically. So it's instead of saying what's the total debt divided by the total GDP, it's saying at the margin, if you add a new dollar of debt, how much new GDP do you add? Right. Now, GDP is a terrible metric. I think it was invented by statists in order to justify statism and central planning. But it's the metric we have. And so what you should see is if you borrow a dollar, you would want to see more than a dollar, hopefully more than $5 added to GDP. That would indicate it's a good investment. If you're running a business and you're contemplating borrowing, you'd want to add something significant to gross revenues. Right. But the actual trend since at least 1950, which is the oldest data set I've been able to get, is that it's been falling. And it jumped back up after in the wake of 2008 for a variety of reasons. But the long-term trend resumed and it's continuing to fall. And so right now you're in the vicinity of about 25 cents. So you borrow a dollar and you add 25 cents to GDP.
So it's actually
so
destructive.
That puts the lie to the claim that, oh, well, we'll grow our way out of the debt.
Mm-hmm.
And I always wonder when people say that, are they aware of the concept of marginal productivity debt? Because it shows the debt, there's a diminishing return. You have to borrow more and more to get less and less.
So do you get back, is 25% the return after the debt's repaid? So in other words, you borrow a buck and you get $1.25 worth of economic activity? Or is it just it's actually counterproductive? And you're only getting 25 cents.
You're getting 25 cents of gross economic activity. Mm-hmm. And then if you're interested in, profits, either tax revenue to the government or corporate profits, which actually service that debt, obviously profits is a small fraction of gross revenue.
Yeah.
So if you're in the business of selling hamburgers and you sell 25 cents worth of hamburgers, what's the profit on that? You'd be lucky to have a penny of profit on 25 cents of revenue.
Right.
And so it's actually even worse than the statistic might suggest.
Right. So the curative or therapeutic value of taking on additional debt is diminishing, and eventually it's going to go negative, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, if you plot the long-term line, depending on, it's like any other chart analysis, depending on where you sort of draw the slope, you can see that it crosses over into negative. It will cross over into negative territory somewhere in the probably 2020s. And when it's negative, that means we're borrowing more and more, and GDP is shrinking. Mm-hmm. And that's obviously a formula for the end, the finite terminus, or what people might call hyperinflationary collapse.
Didn't we really have that, or the beginnings of it, in 2008-09, where more and more debt piled on, and GDP was going down for a number of quarters?
That's right. That's exactly what that looks like. And then obviously they lowered the interest rate, put the pedal to the metal, and sort of temporarily staved off, or as they say, kicked the can down the road. But yeah, that was what had begun to happen, was the debt had begun to unwind.
Mm-hmm. So basically you're saying this is going to happen and we're going to see systemic collapse from it?
That's the inevitable consequence. Unless we change courses, yeah. We have a monetary system that has a couple of features that are sort of intrinsic to it. One is the interest rate is totally unhinged. So interest shot through the moon after World War II up to 1981.
Right.
And then the interest rate's been collapsing ever since. A lot of people are arguing now the interest rate's rising, but I'm happy to go on record as saying no, it isn't. This is just one of the corrections along the way. There have been many other corrections, but the trend is down. Number two, the dollar is irredeemable. The dollar is itself an IOU, and if you pay a debt using IOUs, then all you do is shift the debt, but the debt The economic term is not extinguished. There's no extinguisher of debt because we pay debt using debt. Mm-hmm. And so the debt, therefore, must necessarily grow exponentially. And that's, of course, the inherent to why marginal productivity of debt is falling is because debt is growing exponentially. And all of that growth of debt coming from the accumulated interest is unproductive debt. Mm-hmm. So we're just piling up more and more unproductive debt. We can shift it around. We can hide it on the Fed's balance sheet, but it's not contributing anything to the economy. However, it must be serviced.
Right.
And so then the trick to servicing it is you have to lower the interest rate. So you get the Paul Krugmans of the world saying, hey, what, you know, there's no debt problem. Everything's fine. The interest payment as a proportion of GDP has never been lower. Well, that's right. That's because you're putting your finger on the scales, pushing down the interest rate. But if you push down the interest rate, then you screw everybody else over.
Right.
And so there's an incipient pension fund crisis, for example. And then anybody who's working, trying to save for retirement, how are you supposed to save for retirement if there's no interest and you can't get compounded interest? Mm-hmm. If you're in retirement, how are you supposed to live in retirement if you can't get interest on your savings? And so that gets into my yield purchasing power idea, which is instead of saying if you liquidate all your savings, how much groceries could you buy? Instead, ask if you earn interest on your savings, how much groceries could you buy with the interest?
Right.
That's been in a long time since the early 1980s.
So this is kind of the very definition of financial repression. They're forcing you, if you're saving for retirement, to get into riskier assets. Even if you're later on in your life and you're closing in on retirement, you can't possibly earn enough return the way things are now to retire on it.
That's right. So it's a choice of the tiger or the tiger. Mm-hmm. If you stay in conservative fixed income investments, you can never attain your goals.
Yeah.
And so then they want you to jump into a speculative asset. But then I have to ask the question, is it even possible mathematically for whole generations to retire on nothing more than bidding up the prices of assets?
Mm-hmm.
Does that even make any sense from economics perspective? And of course the answer is no. Then that becomes what they call Ponzi finance.
Right.
Asset prices are endlessly rising. Why? Because everybody's bidding them up. Why? Because everybody has to bid them up and ultimately fueled by falling interest rates.
Mm-hmm. Right. So we see the stock market going up and away, real estate, et cetera. At some point, the Ponzi comes to an end, right?
Yeah, so this process of rising prices and speculation is a process of capital consumption. And so I define speculation, especially in this kind of environment. I'm not talking about in a free market when people might speculate on the price of wheat. But in what we have today, speculation is a process of conversion. And I use that word knowing that there's a legal overtone of an illicit taking or an immoral use of, okay, you're not home for the weekend, so I'll just have a party in your house. And if I clean it up by Sunday night, you'll never know the difference, right?
Right.
A process of conversion of one person's wealth into another person's income. Mm-hmm. And so to use my favorite example, which is Bitcoin, which obviously has not been rising of late, but all through 2017, it was skyrocketing. Mm-hmm. And so each person would buy Bitcoin. So let's say the price of Bitcoin was, $2,000. So person A forks over $2,000 of his hard-earned savings to person B. Why? Because he expects Bitcoin to go up. So person B gets the $2,000, which to him, presumably he bought it, a couple of years earlier when it was $200. So 90% of that is profit to him. He gets to spend person A's wealth as his own income. Now, person A nobody wants to spend their savings. Nobody wants to be the prodigal son and just eat, their family's estate and legacy. But this is perceived to be investing. So he forks it over to this person to buy the Bitcoin. Let's assume he's right. I'm not talking about that the losses occur when the price peaks and then it comes back down. Let's just talk about if he's right and the price goes up, so it goes up to 4,000, person C buys the Bitcoin off of him, that is forks over 4,000 of his hard-earned savings to this person, and this person takes back his original 2,000, and that's his capital. He doesn't want to touch that. But now he has $2,000 of this other person's capital as his own income. So he goes and spends it. Now, why did person C do that? Because he expects the next guy to fork over $8,000.
So it's
and then, so if this is 2017 and this is Bitcoin, sure enough, that did happen.
So, it's
so the next guy pays him person, whatever E, I guess we're up to, pays person D $8,000, $4,000 of which is now income to person D, and he spends that, spends somebody else's, you know, somebody else's former wealth as his income, and that person spent $8,000 because he expects it to go to 16, which did happen in late 2017. And so on and on and on with this process of spending capital.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the most pernicious force. I think it's no exaggeration to say that one of the key forces that took us out of the dark ages, you know, many centuries ago, was the ability to earn interest and accumulate capital.
Right.
It's capital accumulation that allows us to be, you know, so extraordinarily wealthy. And now in this zero interest rate environment, we slammed that force of civilization into reverse by encouraging capital decumulation.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, you know, endless bubbling asset prices.
Capital destruction, right?
Mm-hmm.
So going back to the Bitcoin thing, so it basically relied upon the greater fool theory, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily put it in those terms because I don't want to put the emphasis that somebody's a fool or somebody's making a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
I look at it that if people are doing perverse things, especially large numbers of, I mean, there can always be an individual fool, but if the entire market is doing something that you realize is irrational, it may be because, in this case, the Federal Reserve is applying a perverse incentive. And if you perversely incentivize people, then you get perverse outcomes, and perverse behaviors lead to perverse outcomes. So the Fed, as you were saying a moment ago, says, okay, we're going to take away from you the ability to earn interest on a real investment. You're now forced to find something to speculate in and seek a speculative capital gain as a surrogate for the interest that you would have earned and had we had a normal free market.
Right.
And so whether those people go into a speculation that we would regard as sensible, such as betting on the price of gold going up, or whether they go into something that we regard as nonsensical, such as buying Bitcoin, it's all the same. It's channeling the same force in the same way, only into different markets. That's people are forced to find something that's going up. And so, of course, that becomes self-fulfilling. It does go up because everybody's buying it in the hopes that it will go up. And then those who buy early and get out early are the winners. And obviously those who buy too late, you know, somebody bought Bitcoin at $19,900-something. Then obviously those are the losers. But from an economics perspective, you know, my point in looking at marginal productivity of debt and looking at speculation as a conversion, we're all losers because we're converting, you know, all of the accumulated capital to income to be spent. And that's why, getting back to your question, does this end in a collapse? And does this potentially destroy our civilization? And the reason why I say yes to that, it's not just the paper accounting of what's going on, it's that real capital is being consumed. And once it's consumed, it's irrevocably gone. You know, capital is hard to accumulate, hard to produce, and easy to spend. And that's this process that's now racing exponentially through our monetary system.
Interesting take on it. And there's a lot of substance to what you're saying. Does that mean that Bitcoin's not going to have another run, or cryptocurrencies? They ran out of fools, or what?
I wrote a whole series of articles on Bitcoin arguing it's not sound and it's not money. But all through that series of articles, which I think was July through October approximately, I was very careful not to try to make any predictions about the price of it. Just because it's not sound doesn't mean it couldn't double and double again.
Yeah.
And so here we are now in the 6,000s, at least as of Friday. I didn't look this morning. It doesn't mean that it couldn't go to 20,000 or 50,000 or even a million. But at the end of the day, it isn't sound. And so everybody who's putting their capital into it, unless they're agile and nimble and ahead of the crowd, somebody's going to be left holding a very big bag. And from a systemic perspective, a lot of accumulated savings will be consumed and go up in smoke.
Yeah, right now it's trading just under 6,500 at 6,462 per Bitcoin. I agree with you about not predicting prices in a bubble because they often don't follow predictable courses. However, I just happen to have written an article on December 17th explaining why the Bitcoin bubble was going to burst imminently, and it's pretty spot on. So, but before that, you know, I think it's going to be multiple bubbles because the draw of it, the illusion of it, perhaps. And I'm not sure that it's all illusional, because if everything's going to blow up, maybe you're better off not being in a government-backed asset. Yeah, I don't know the answer to it, but to me, it was quite predictable that it was going to blow up when it did. And I think we're just, it's the nature of the beast is that it is a bubble-like asset, for lack of a better term, and it will go through these multiple bubbles over periods of time. I don't think it's run its course yet, but we will see about it. So people want to find out more about you, Keith, about what you're doing, read your articles. Where's the best place to go to?
So as you said before, our website, monetary-metals.com, there's one thing I could add to that. We pay interest on gold.
Oh, well,
so we're trying to help fix the system by returning to what occurs in the free market, which is a yield, not a speculation gain, but an actual yield doing something productive and doing it on real money, which is gold.
And that's a good thing for sure. Hey, we'll have a link to your site, Keith, in the show notes to this interview on financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Make sure you sign up for the newsletter. Hey, take a look at the site. If you've got any questions or comments for Keith or myself, which I'm sure you do, you know the email address is kl@carrylutz.com, Twitter feed @CarrieLutz, Facebook page Financial Survival Network. Keith, been great having you on. Thanks for coming, and we will definitely have you on in the future.
All right, thanks for having me.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.